This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by You Build It. Let's find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
Well, there might be a fix in the mix for the drug possession law, or the now lack of felony drug possession law that was dismissed by the state Supreme Court for ridiculous reasons. It was ruled unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court back in February. And since then, and because of that, drugs have become legalized, drug possession. And it's retroactive. Well, the fix, a law, passed the Senate. We talked about it on Friday. It makes possessing a small amount of drugs a gross misdemeanor. A personal possession law calls it out as a gross misdemeanor instead of a felony. It's punishable by up to a year in jail. I believe that there is a small monetary fine attached to that potentially as well. And that is generally seen as up to the judge. And I say small possession, personal possession, because obviously it's still a felony if you were to be found to be a drug dealer. Now, the sponsor of the original bill that ended up passing in the Senate, one of the sponsors, was Senator Monica Dingra. She is the Democrat from Kirkland. She ended up voting against it when they made some changes, because the original bill was just across the board. They were going to legalize it, no penalties whatsoever. But then they added that gross misdemeanor penalty. And so she told Cairo 7 TV.
Unfortunately, it's the brown and black individuals who are going to be stopped more and frisked more.
None of what she just said is true. Literally none of what she just said is true. She is lying to you. That is totally disconnected from policing. Now, she'll say, oh, well, I've got a background as a prosecutor. And that is supposed to be meant to convince you that she knows what she's talking about, when the truth is she knows then that she's lying. Because she has prosecutorial experience in King County, where people are not frisked nor stopped because of suspected drug use. That was the case before the Supreme Court got rid of the felony drug possession law. The people who are frisked and stopped are drug dealers. That part's true. Drug dealers, which, of course, her original bill, she claimed, wouldn't have been impacted. In King County, drug use, open drug use, is not arrested nor prosecuted for. End of story. It doesn't matter if you're black or brown, which she throws in there because she wants to make this about equity and social justice, racial justice. She is all about that. She thinks it's going to earn her some extra points in Kirkland, where the demographics of her district are starting to shift further and further and further to the left. She wants you to believe that she's a hero fighting for people of color. She is not. She is not. Anytime you take away any kind of penalty for drug use, you make it easier for that drug user, black, brown, Asian, white, whatever, you make it easier for them to stay on that pathway, which leads to inevitable death. That is the fact of the matter. Look at the data. Look at the policing. Maybe instead of demonizing police, Democrats should talk to a few of them. Maybe they'd understand. And she tells Cairo 7 TV that it is wrong to use a criminal justice system to pressure drug users to get treatment. She says that as a prosecutor who presumably offered plea deals at some point in her career, leveraging the criminal justice system, using it to put pressure on people who are breaking the law to get them to do something that she wanted them to do. Representative Roger Goodman, another Democrat who's veering so far to the left, he's become unrecognizable. He says something else that is just flatly untrue.
There's a lot of evidence that when treatment is made available, people take it. They go to it. They don't need to be threatened to go into treatment.
Okay, well, that must explain why there's so many dead addicts dying on the streets after skipping treatment. It's so weird how often we've done stories on this show, and others in this market have done it as well, where repeat offender after repeat offender after repeat offender, who's a drug user, an addict, is offered treatment, told they have to go to treatment, and don't go, and end up either dead or they end up re-victimizing people. Why doesn't it work then? Roger Goodman, where's all that data that you're pulling from? There's no doubt that it works for some people. There's no doubt. It doesn't work for everybody. There are a lot of people who will not seek treatment because they are overcome with their addiction. They're clouded by that addiction. That's how addiction works. And as a result, they keep doing the same behavior over and over and over again. And the only thing that could help them and us, the public that they are victimizing, is to throw these people in jail. So they bring it back to the House, this drug legalization bill. He's going to try to take out the criminal penalty, and instead, he's going to add a civil penalty.
We're going to put a structure in place where law enforcement can intervene, where they can confiscate the substance, and where they can issue a penalty of some sort.
Oh, yeah? Really? Are you? A penalty? Like a ticket? Wouldn't that be targeting someone for their addiction? Wouldn't that be disproportionately targeting our black and brown community members? Wouldn't that upset Monka Dhingra or Joe Wynn over in the state Senate side? Wouldn't that upset them? Why isn't that punishing addicts? You see, when you come up with nonsensical logic to say no to the criminalization, you end up using that nonsensical logic yourself in what you're trying to fix. And this is their fix? Joe Wynn is another senator, Democrat, white center. Very, very, very far to the left. We talked about him yesterday. He was also an original sponsor of that Senate bill. He voted no at the end of the day because it took out the legalization part and added a penalty. He believes possession should stay decriminalized in the state. And by decriminalized, he means legal. He wants the legalization of drugs and says you should just be treating all these folks as patients, not criminals, even though they're breaking the law.
Everybody understands that people who need it should get treatment. It's a matter of how do we get them in the door. Some people believe that we should be treating them like patients and be more therapeutic. Some people think that they need a stick, and having that criminal code there is that stick.
Thank you for helping us understand. You're correct. It is the stick. Carrot and stick approach works for people. It does. Carrot and stick approach works for people whether or not they're addicts. Sometimes it doesn't, which is why we don't always say we throw every addict in jail. We don't do that. We don't take that approach now. But here's what it means when they say they just want to legalize drugs, where they don't want to take drug crimes and criminals seriously. Those people end up just committing more crimes. Because remember, for a drug user to go to jail in this state for just simple drug possession, outside of the drug dealers who plead down to that, it takes a lot. It is not easy. It is not quick. Prosecutors across the state do not do it often. It doesn't matter if it's in King County or Thurston County. Doesn't matter if it's in the city of Republic or Longview. It is not easy to put drug users or addicts in jail. Rightly so. Because I, too, prefer treatment over jail time. But Inslee just released 18 people from jail. He commuted their sentences. They were serving prison time on drug possession convictions. He commuted them instead of having them go and petition the court so that they could abide by the Supreme Court ruling. Now, of the 18 that was released was Randall Toffity. 2 days after he was released, he was arrested for allegedly driving 120 miles per hour through neighborhoods out in Thurston County. Now, according to the deputies, when they caught up to him, he was smiling and he said, quote, "Governor Inslee let me out of prison early and I wanted to have some fun." That's awfully specific. Gina Mossbrucker, our friend, state representative from Goldendale Republican, she spoke with King 5 and said she supports the move of treatment over incarceration like most people. But let's be clear, you still need to punish because stuff like this is going to happen.
I unfortunately think we're going to see more of that. And we're going to see people get out without infrastructure in place.
The infrastructure isn't in place. Democrats want to continue to ignore it. You're listening to The Jason Rants Show. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
There are a lot of Democrats who have decided that they're going to take money from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez while at the same time pretending that this is not a party that has embraced socialism. Our very own Kim Schreier, Congresswoman, who, if you didn't know, she's a doctor, which she'll tell you 14 times in every conversation you have with her. She decided to take money from AOC. Well, the National Republican Congressional Committee says you should probably be giving that money back. They've launched a new website, socialistgiveback.com. Joining me on the line to discuss is the NRCC Regional Press Secretary, Courtney Perella. Courtney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on today, Jason.
So take us through how much money Kim Schreier and other Democrats are receiving from AOC.
So AOC has donated $5,000 each to vulnerable House Democrats, and that's why we launched socialistgiveback.com to highlight these vulnerable Democrats who are taking donations from AOC and raise awareness that unless they give these campaign donations back, they're showing their constituents that they stand with AOC and her socialist agenda. Like you Jim Schreier has taken a donation, and unlike six other vulnerable Democrats, she has not returned that $5,000.
What's funny about this whole thing is they're vulnerable for the very reason for taking money from AOC and for AOC's existence. That's why they're so especially vulnerable.
Exactly. And our goal is to show that House Democrats stand with AOC's radical socialist agenda. This isn't some fringe movement. This is the platform of the Democrat Party. And Kim Schreier is letting everyone know that she is on board. On board with the platform that wants to defund the police, ban private health insurance, raise taxes, and open our borders.
So who are the Democrats that gave money back?
Democrats that gave money back, Chris Pappas, Ron Kimes, Carolyn Bordeaux from Georgia, Connor Lamb, Tom Malinowski, and Alyssa Slotkin from Michigan have all returned these donations or declined it. Kim Schreier has not.
Well, Kim Schreier's a far left Democrat, progressive, socialist, friendly member of Congress who represents Seattle, even though she doesn't actually live in Seattle nor actually supposed to represent Seattle. And yet those are the values that she holds. What's curious about this is a lot of the people on that list, like Congresswoman Slotkin, for example, she is one of those people who have pushed back against the radical leftist agenda within her party. I mean, I don't want one party rule. I'm certainly okay with two parties or three parties because it essentially forces everyone to come to the table and represent everyone. She's the kind of Democrat that I could support if I had to choose a Democrat. And yet she is being pushed out of the party to make room for folks like an AOC or an Ilhan Omar or a Kim Schreier.
Right, exactly. And Kim Schreier, again, is proving to the constituents in Washington's 8th District, and like you said, Seattle and all across the state, really, that she stands with this platform from the Democrat Party, the socialist radical platform from the far left that the Democrats are embracing.
So the last two congressional races, Kim Schreier has been deemed a vulnerable Democrat, and yet lots of money pour in from the Democrats, and they're able to keep her in office. Why might this next cycle be different?
Well, we're confident this cycle that a candidate will emerge who can and will beat Kim Schreier in the 2022 election. Like you said, she is vulnerable. She's proving to her constituents that she stands on board with the Democrat platform to defund the police, to have open borders. We're looking at a border crisis right now. I mean, look no further than the crime that you're seeing in Seattle from this defund the police movement from the Democrats. Where's Kim Schreier on that? Why isn't she standing up for the people of Washington? She's making herself vulnerable, and we're confident that someone will beat her in 2022.
Yeah, I don't understand the strategy coming from the Democratic Party right now. I know a lot of people want to pretend that the House race, because Republicans didn't take control, which no one thought they were going to take control this last election, that somehow it meant that they did poorly because of the results of the presidential election. But to be clear, the House Republicans did way better than expected, and the Democrats did way worse than anyone could have possibly imagined. And it was due to not just the defunding of the police, but because of their hard left turn. Is there any indication that they've learned a lesson?
Clearly not. And I'm going to go ahead and say it. House Democrats are making mistakes by embracing this radical socialist agenda. And we're going to hold them accountable for these mistakes and joining the radical socialist platform. House Republicans are poised to retake the majority in 2022.
Well, fingers crossed, we'll be doing what we can to make sure that happens. Courtney Perella is the NRCC Regional Press Secretary. The website, socialistgiveback.com. Go there now if you want to learn more about how you can put on the pressure for Kim Schreier to give back the money that she's taken from AOC, all while she wants to pretend that she actually represents her district, which is not Seattle, but places like Enumclaw and Issaquah, which are not Seattle friendly, yet she's the one who represents them. Thank you so much, Courtney, for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You as well. You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The coronavirus.
So let's just briefly talk about the controversy over wearing a mask, whether you've been fully vaccinated or whether you're outside, because this topic is constantly popping up because of really inconsistent and weird talking points coming from Dr. Fauci and the Biden administration. They really do need to just take him off of TV, because he is a big reason now why there is more and more people who are starting to have doubts about getting the vaccine. And I thought we were at a point up until the J&J pause. I thought we were at a point where people finally said, okay, this does make sense, or at least a majority of people. I know a lot of people out there who are listening right now, with respect, you guys are wrong, that believe that there's some sort of conspiracy to get the vaccine. You should get the vaccine, I believe, but it should be up to you. I'm not going to force you. I don't want the government to force you. You do you. Do what you want. Be responsible for yourself and for your family and make the right choices based on what you believe. I just hope you don't buy into some of the conspiracy theories. But Dr. Fauci, I think now, is a reason why some of these conspiracy theories are being pushed, because he is not making a lot of sense. Now, from a position of purely focusing on having zero deaths or zero infections, his commentary, I suppose, makes sense, but he's not talking about it in that way. He is making policy discussions, or he's informing policy. So when he says that you should continue to wear a mask even if you've been vaccinated, not just gotten half of the vaccine, but gotten the full two of them, that you should continue to wear a mask because even though you cut down on your risk dramatically of getting COVID, you might end up getting it and not even realize it. And as a result, you might end up giving it to somebody else. But my point has been, since he started to push this nonsense, is if you're fully vaccinated, the people around you who are not fully vaccinated should be wearing a mask, not you. We were told by Dr. Fauci, you know, after he told us masks don't work, that masks will protect you, that it cuts down on your risk dramatically. Now, it's not 100%, that is true, but it cuts down on your risk dramatically. So why is the message not, in order to get more shots in arms, wear a mask if you have not been vaccinated? Why is that not part of the talking point? Why is it, yeah, we're going to have you get two shots, which is incredibly inconvenient, and you're going to get a third one, a booster shot, in a few months, 6 months, maybe a year, whatever it is. And for that trouble, to go through that hassle, you change nothing. You still wear your mask. It is a bizarre talking point. But more bizarre to me is this idea that you should still be wearing your mask outside. That's bizarre. So let's talk about both of those. Now, again, on the first part of wearing a mask despite being vaccinated, David Leonhard, or Leonhard, he's a reporter with the New York Times. He posted this string of tweets, a thread, going through all of the reasons why the vaccine is actually really effective. And it cuts down on your chances of not just getting COVID, but spreading COVID dramatically. Okay? And it's really good, point by point, fact-based, all the way until the last tweet, in which he says, if you are vaccinated, still wear a mask in some situations, even though, yes, the medical benefits are tiny. It contributes to a culture of safety and is a sign of solidarity with the unvaccinated, who remain a majority of Americans. They deserve your support. That is so absolutely ludicrous. I am not going to wear a mask out of solidarity. I am not going to wear a mask to signal my virtue. I will wear a mask where I have to, because I'm not going to hassle individual businesses. I'm not going to put them in a weird position. But I'm not going to wear a mask outside where there is little to no risk of contracting or spreading COVID, whether or not I'm vaccinated. Once I'm fully vaccinated, no, there's no way I'm wearing a mask outside. Sorry, I'm out. Not going to do it. How about this? Your sign of solidarity could be getting the vaccine. This is ludicrous. But now on the outdoor stuff, Israel, the entire country, just ended its outdoor mask mandate. They just got rid of it. Why? Because the numbers are good. Because the cases are down. Because they are not seeing the infections that we keep getting told is, oh, it's going to be the end of the world. No, it's not there. The health minister, Yuli Edelstein, the rate of infection in Israel is very low thanks to successful vaccine campaign in Israel, and therefore it is possible to ease restrictions. The cases have fallen to a 7-day average of just 167. 167. COVID deaths have dropped to an average of 6 over the 7-day average. So they're saying, yeah, you can go outside safely, because the country of Israel is actually following the science and the data, unlike this country, which is choosing to ignore it. They're choosing to listen to people like Dr. Fauci, whose end goal might be noble in that he wants zero cases and zero deaths, because as a doctor, he wants to do no harm. Okay. But that's not how you inform policy. That's not a good policy. That's not a policy for anything. We don't say we're going to ban cars because we got to make sure that no one ever dies in a car accident. We mitigate. We do what we can, like telling people to wear seatbelts or telling people to get vaccinated and wash their hands. But we don't ban the car for fear that someone's going to die. There's always going to be a risk, so you mitigate around it. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. Welcome back to the Jason Ranch Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Today is day one to the HR and SR1 bill being considered by the Senate and the House on the federal level. This would take over, effectively take over, I should say, elections from the states. It's a move that both Republicans and actually Democrats have been calling out. Yesterday, we spoke with Ken Cuccinelli to give us the national outlook, and we thought today we would check in with our own Secretary of State, Kim Wyman, who spoke out in a committee hearing against this particular bill to give us her perspective. And she joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Jason.
So if you could first give us from your perspective, obviously Washington State is a mail-in state. It would be impacted significantly differently than other states. But take us through H.R. 1, this bill in general, on how it would impact Washington and how you see it impacting just the country in a more general sense.
Well, H.R. 1 really is trying to establish some baseline things that every state will have to adopt to conduct elections, federal elections anyway. And Washington is well positioned because many of the parts of H.R. 1 we already do. Same-day registration, automatically registering people that get an enhanced driver's license, pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. The problem with H.R. 1 for even Washington is that it is so prescriptive that it is going to force us to have to make changes to our system, and it's going to make some of those requirements impossible for states to comply, and being out of compliance would then set up, you know, tons of litigation in 2022 and beyond.
Like what? Give us some examples of what this legislation would do that would be nearly impossible for these states to be able to adhere to, at least simply.
The biggest one is it requires an adoption by states of the voting. This is going to get really wonky for a second, but basically the system standards for our ballot tabulation systems. It's a BBSG 2.0. It took election officials and the Election Assistance Commission about 5-6 years to draft these and get them out. They just were passed, and this bill would require that every system used in the country has to be tested to these standards by 2022, which is just next year. And right now, as we sit here today, we don't even have labs that are ready to test to that standard, let alone the capacity to test all of the systems nationwide, which would mean they would be decertified. And the last thing we need to do is count ballots on decertified equipment in the 2022 election. So that's just one example of that prescriptive nature. For our state, it's also some requirements on expanding voter registration to various agencies. And the expansion, the way that they have it written right now is, I'm going down a rabbit hole again. But basically, it would require us to automatically register people to vote that haven't necessarily proved that they're eligible or may not even want to be registered to vote. And so, you know, currently Washington state system allows for automatic registration of people who get an enhanced driver's license. These are people who have proved citizenship and they can opt out. H.R. 1 would flip all of that on its head, and now you'd have to opt, you know, it would be every voter would have to opt out of the system. And we're going to end up registering people who don't want to register because they're not eligible and they don't want to risk becoming a citizen down the road because they were inadvertently registered to vote.
So the other thing, two issues that we talked about with Ken Cuccinelli is that, to your point, same-day registration, which you can do here in Washington, but it also bans state voter ID laws. So you would not have to show an ID same day where you set up your registration. Now, there are significant concerns, reasonable concerns, especially from the perspective of a state that doesn't already allow for same-day registration. But how does same-day registration work in Washington State, and how would it work if you're not able to look at a voter ID?
But it would be problematic. I think that what we really try to do here in Washington State, and I think do a very good job of, is balancing increases to access with increases of security. So when we moved to same-day registration, we had the VoteWa registration system up and running. So counties are talking to each other in live time on Election Day. So if Jason Rance goes into the Pierce County Auditor's Office on Election Day and says, hey, I need to register to vote and update my registration, they can pull up your registration, see if you've been issued a ballot already. If you have, they can suspend it. If you've already had it counted or had it, you know, processed, they won't be able to issue a ballot. But we can ensure with the current system that no matter how many ballots you're given, only one will be counted for you. Now, if you don't have that security in place in a state, you're going to really open up a situation where we can't defend against the fraud claims that people are going to make that, you know, you could just register in 10 counties and vote 10 ballots and there's no way to prevent it. If you don't build out that compensating control and security measures, you won't be able to defend the system.
Exactly. And that would be true. In a state that doesn't have this kind of, I could literally go into different counties and presumably I could even go to the same county depending on how the back end is set up and just say, oh, no, I haven't registered to give me that ballot. And by the way, I'm not even going to give you my ID. So I don't even know how they would check to see if you were registered in that county. How would that even work?
Correct. And that's those are all the really relevant questions. And the other thing that really is lost, I think, on this discussion is just the sheer number of local voting jurisdictions there are in the country. You and I have had this conversation. There are over 10,000, you know, localities, townships, small counties that run these elections. And so if they have to have something in a polling place on Election Day that can connect to the other, in Wisconsin's case, 1,600 townships that are in local jurisdictions that are conducting their election, you've got a security nightmare on the cyber side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you connect all those poll books? How do you connect all of the poll workers working in those locations? And, you know, that creates way more trouble than it's worth for the risk.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kim Wyman, who is the Secretary of State of Washington, Republican, about H.R. 1, which would dramatically change the way elections are held in the United States. It would effectively seize the authority of states to regulate voter registration, to handle the elections process, and give it to an unelected commission equally divided of Republicans and Democrats plus one independent, which I don't even understand the independent side of that, because the independent's going to obviously side with a Republican or a Democrat. So how we have independents right now who caucus with the Democrats. So how that ends up getting figured out, I don't even know. This is obviously coming at a time where Democrats are claiming the new Georgia law is Jim Crow 2.0. I have no problem with anyone who wants to criticize and debate any law, voter registration, voting lines, whatever it is. Do you think it is in good faith to call something Jim Crow 2.0?
No. And, you know, really coming out of 2020, the biggest thing that I'm concerned about is this hyper-partisanship of administrative processes like elections. And both sides are doing it. I mean, we've certainly experienced it here in Washington. And again, you and I have had this conversation quite a bit about voter fraud. And that's the right's, you know, criticism. And the left is voter suppression. And definitely Stacey Abrams, who lost the governor's race in Georgia, threw a lot of gasoline on the fire for those elections. Those law changes in Georgia out of the gate, called on Major League Baseball and you know, corporations to step up and denounce them. And she framed it from the get-go that it was Jim Crow era, you know, voter fraud. Of course, the part that got left out is Georgia, even with those changes, had more accessibility to their elections than even the president's home state. So we have to kind of just take a step back on both sides and stop talking about this stuff in these just really divisive terms and start working together to address both sides' concerns.
Yeah, and it just seems like in the Georgia issue, it's being set up that way for the sheer purpose of passing H.R. 1.
Correct. That is my take as well.
It's disgusting.
And, yeah. Yeah, the other piece is legislatures and Congress, you need both sides at the table, and both sides need to talk and work together and work through, dare I say, compromises to come up with legislation that addresses both the fears of suppression and fraud.
Well, there you go. Kim Wyman, Secretary of State, thank you for giving us your analysis of this bill, because obviously it impacts Washington, it impacts the entire country, but that includes Washington. And you know, I love the Democrats who turn to Washington when it's convenient to them and say, look, the system works there, it's great. Well, now they want to change our system for a process that you're saying no, would not be good for Washington. Kim Wyman, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Jason Rantz Show. Back to the Jason Rantz Show on this Tuesday afternoon, a beautiful Tuesday afternoon. Thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast in case you miss any moment of this show. Just text podcast to 1-800-465-8770. I was on with the Faulkner Focus earlier today, and we were talking about the civil unrest that is likely to come, is expected to come after the Chauvin trial verdict, whatever, frankly, the verdict actually is. We talked a little bit about it earlier on in the show with comments from Ilhan Omar and President Joe Biden getting involved. They are making it worse. There are a lot of folks making it worse. Maxine Waters is making it worse. And it's almost like they're doing this on purpose. It serves a political agenda. I think in some cases, some are doing it on purpose because of that very reason. It helps them politically. So are we ready? Everything on the ground tells us, well, yes, on paper, we're ready. We certainly know what is possible, whether we're talking about Minneapolis or here in Seattle. We know what is likely to happen given certain results of the trial. We know about the civil unrest that will occur. But just because we know what's going to happen doesn't mean that cities are going to be as prepared as you think. We know on paper they're prepared, but you actually have to be willing to use law enforcement, which was a part of the conversation earlier this morning.
All right, I want to get back to what's unfolding right now on the streets of Minneapolis ahead of the verdict. Jason Rantz joins me, radio talk show host for the KTTH in Seattle. You've seen so much unrest on your own streets. First of all, quick top line thoughts on all of the response that is happening on the ground there.
Well, look, it sounds like they say they're prepared, and certainly from a staffing perspective, that appears to be the case, but you're only as prepared as you are willing to use the law enforcement that you have on the ground. We've seen for the last year a reticence from individual mayors and councils and police chiefs to actually use any sort of force when being met with this kind of rioting. And so if you don't use that overwhelming force to stop it, it just gets worse. And yet when you use any force, you have some voices out there who are fanning the flames, like Maxine Waters and Rashida Tlaib, who will say this is the militarization and the over-policing of neighborhoods. So police are caught in really difficult positions. You just need some leaders to stand up, and I hope they do that in Minneapolis and, frankly, across the country.
Yeah, well, maybe Maxine Waters should stay home. Detroit's police chief, James Craig, says that the Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who you just mentioned, should resign after calling for no more police. Let's watch.
I'd be the first person to call for a resignation and throw her a going-away party. She needs to be censored. All this rhetoric is not helping the situation. It's putting our police officers in danger. It's making our communities less safe. Be quiet and take on a role of leadership.
Jason.
Well, she's not going to resign. I don't think she should resign, frankly, because, look, members of the voting public get to put in people in positions of power, including ones who are monsters, who want what's worst for this country, not what's best. That's for them to decide. I will say we need to look at this bigger picture. This is not just about Rashida Tlaib. The chief is correct. She is destructive. But let's not pretend that she's the only one doing this. This is a loud part of the Democratic Party that has been pushing to defund police, and we are now living the consequences. It's time for voters to step up and say, you guys, we are all the ones who are the victims of this. Look in Detroit. Yeah. See if defunding the police is what really is going to fix the high murder rate there.
And in the meantime, we need for those police to feel supported enough to do their jobs.
I end up saying back the blue there as well, but my microphone might have been cut by that point. So I want to just follow up briefly on this because we were expected to go an extra minute and a half, 2 minutes, but Joe Biden decided to speak. So it cut it a little bit short. But this idea that the chief of police in Detroit, who's a good man, is calling for Rashida Tlaib to resign. No, I generally reject that. If people in the district want to push back and recall, that's one thing. But I don't think we should just be calling on people to resign because we don't like their political beliefs, as bad faith as they are. The fact of the matter is, if we want to ensure that people like Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar or Mondaire Jones or Jerry Nadler or Ed Markey or whomever do not get elected again, the people have to make that decision on the ground. Now, I'm not naive to think that in Detroit, where Rashida Tlaib is the congresswoman, or Dearborn Heights, that all of a sudden they're going to get conservative and put in a Republican. They're not. But I'm hopeful that we can get a more moderate Democrat to step up and hopefully push back on some of this really dangerous rhetoric. All the folks in Detroit need to do is look at their high rates of homicides, look at the high rates of black people being murdered, and ask themselves if it's the police doing it or if it's someone else. Now, of course, we know it's not the police. So claiming that police are all racist and they're out there murdering people and we need to abolish the police, obviously that is not going to fix the problem. So what the voters there need to do is come together and talk to one another, ignore all the crazies, and say, what is best for our community? And I think if you put in front of them a good candidate who's going to be able to connect the dots better, they're going to realize it's not Rashida Tlaib. I would rather have that happen than her just resign, which is not going to happen, but in a world in which it did, and then just have another crazy person step up and take on that position. We want organic change, authentic change. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it. I'll be on Tucker Carlson. The video is up shortly, will be up shortly at youtube.com/JasonRants. I'll see you tomorrow. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.